Just Not Good Enough with Chaz House on FUBAR Radio.
Firstly, welcome Ruth Davidson to Just Not Good Enough. Just very briefly then, you were born in Scotland, you worked as a journalist at the BBC, you served in the Territorial Army, you left the BBC to go to Glasgow University and joined the Conservative Party, and that was in 2009. And then 2 years later, you were elected to Scottish Parliament, and then months later, you stood for election to be the head of the Conservatives, which you got. But then in 2020, when you stood down, and you're now a life peer in the House of Lords, and you, in 2011, you became the first openly gay political leader in the UK. But you've struggled with mental health for quite some time, particularly as a teenager. So why the hell did you go into politics?
Well, I prefer to think of the fact that I've managed my mental health pretty much for all of my adult life. So when I was at university, I went to university at 17, I went to Edinburgh University to study English literature. In my first year, I was diagnosed with clinical depression, and, you know, tried some talking therapies, was put on antidepressants, struggled quite a lot. Took me quite a long time to kind of figure out that the antidepressants weren't massively helping me, but every time I kind of went back and I was still not getting any better, you know, the dosage would just be doubled every time. Yeah. So it took me quite a long time from 18 to try and kind of sort out the strands of what that meant. And, you know, I'm talking way back in the 90s there. And you know, what we know about mental health has come on so much, and it's been destigmatized in a way that, you know, I couldn't even have imagined or dreamed of back then. But I genuinely didn't know that much about it. And in my teenage, you know, when I was given the diagnosis, I genuinely, or does this mean I'm mad? Does this mean that I'll never hold down a good job? You know, what does this actually mean? You know, and I'd been sent away from the student health centre with a leaflet from the NHS that said, you know, one of the things that helps is to clean out your cupboards at home. And it all just felt a bit weird.
Clean out your cupboards at home. Sorry to interrupt, but clean out your cupboards at home.
Yeah, so it was a leaflet that basically, I mean, it talked about some of the things that you can do to help your mental health, which included things like playing sport or doing, you know, doing exercise.
Yeah.
But there was a line in it that was also, or you could just clean out your cupboards at home. And it felt to me at the time that was quite an anachronistic thing to tell people that I'd had a diagnosis.
Yeah. Yeah.
To do.
I'm going to try it.
It jarred with me, and it's just always stuck in my head.
Yeah, that's so. Can you just describe then, you know, you've got the diagnosis, but at that point you're realising that you have got, and you're saying you thought you're mentally ill or whatever, or young mad. But how does it kick in? Are there sort of triggers? Are there, you know, how does it change your mood?
And I didn't quite identify this at the time. So I thought it was kind of wrapped up with going to university and feeling a massive sense of imposter syndrome. You know, I'd been quite bright at school. I went to, you know, my local comprehensive. I suddenly went to Edinburgh University at the age of 17, having done Scottish Ayers. And all the courses seemed to be geared to people that had already done A-levels. Lots of people in my year had been through the English school system. They'd also gone off and done a gap year or two, you know, building orphanages in Tanzania or looking after orangutans in Borneo or whatever it was. And you know, some of them were kind of 19, 20 in the same year as me. And irrespective of the age gap, they were also just so confident. And it took me years to work out that kind of confidence isn't the same thing as ability. And, you know, knowledge isn't actually the same thing as intelligence. So maybe their coursework had covered different things to mine, but actually they might not have been any smarter than me. So I think that was part of it. And I think the trigger for me was when I was a kid, when I was 5 years old, I was run over by a truck outside my house. I was in hospital for a very long time, broke my legs, fractured my pelvis, crushed my femoral artery. It took months to, first of all, they had to save my life, then they saved a leg. It took me months to learn how to walk again and be able to return to school. And, you know, being a five-year-old at school with a Zimmer frame's not much fun, let me tell you, and that sort of thing. And then a few years later, a kid that lived across the road from me was also run over on the same stretch of road. He was a neighbour that lived on the other side of the street. He's a bit older than me, sort of 3 or 4 years older than me. And he also suffered leg injuries and foot injuries, a bit less than that. And he had lots of other things going on in his life. And fast forward again to when I was in my first year at university, and he ended up committing suicide. And we weren't that close, you know, we weren't really close friends, although we had friends in common that were in the same group. And I just had this overwhelming sense that I didn't deserve to live. It was the oddest thing
What
that
sparked that? Was that is that a like 'cause the reason I ask this is because a friend of mine committed suicide about 2 weeks ago, right? And we were
I'm so
hardly
sorry.
oh no, and I'm actually quite devastated by it because she was absolutely lovely, and she left this note saying, "I don't want to live anymore. Can somebody look after my cat?" And that was it. And I feel really guilty about that because I didn't reach out to her before. I don't, did you ever have any? Did you get that sort of emotional response as well?
I mean, like I say, we weren't that close, and there was a bit of an age gap. But we had, because we came from this very small village, we had friends in common that were close to him and that were closer to me. I didn't feel like I didn't have a savior syndrome. I didn't feel like I should have saved him. That wasn't what it was. The overwhelming thing was that we'd both had this life event. Mine was much more serious than his, and even though his suicide wasn't a result of his injuries, because this was years and years later, and it was years and years after me, was that somehow he was dead and I was alive, and I didn't deserve it, and that I wasn't a good enough person, that I wasn't contributing enough, that I didn't like myself very much. So there was lots of stuff that was wrapped up in it. So I think, looking back, although I didn't appreciate it at the time, I think that kind of opened the floodgates to a lot of things that I was already feeling about myself. So I've always said it was kind of a trigger, but not a cause. Does that make any
Yes, no,
sense?
it does. But were you conscious of this before you got
No,
to
not at
that
the time.
point?
No, I didn't kind of link the two things till a long time after.
It takes ages, doesn't it? I mean, I'm, getting on now, but it's taken me probably 60 years to realize that I've had mental health since I was very, very young, and not known about it. And I'm quite cross with myself that I didn't do anything about it because, one, I didn't know, and two, would I have spoken about it? I don't know.
It's funny because I, by all accounts, and certainly in my own memory, was a very happy child. Like once I was able to kind of walk and run and climb trees again and things, I was a very active child. The kind of accident, I mean, I've always walked a bit funny. I've got one leg longer than the other, one foot bigger than the other, but like it's not noticeable. Nobody would think that I'd had, quite a big event like that. And it certainly hasn't stopped me doing anything. I played football for a boys' team. I played squash at county level and things like that, and for my university and stuff. So like I've always been very active. It didn't prohibit me joining the Territorial Army. I could pass all the fitness tests. I could do all of that. So I think it just combined with lots of other things, and I think, being a teenager is hard. Going to university can be hard. Feeling isolated, feeling like you're removed from the things that you know. But it was more than just I was a bit miserable. I mean, it was genuine depression, and it was self-punishment and self-harm, and other things that went along with it. And I really reacted not very well to counselling. I didn't really have the maturity to understand or to seek it or to want to be open in that space. I actually think that if I went back and did it now, I would find a much greater benefit from it. I just had in my head that this person was being paid to care, and that meant that they really didn't. So why was I even there? So that didn't really work for me.
But
And
isn't that part of the reaction to being with yourself, being who you
I think
are?
it is. I mean, I was quite angry about lots of things, and I probably drank a bit too much, as students do, and lots of other stuff. And then I came out in my sort of early to mid 20s, about 24 or so, after I'd left university, been gone for a while. But I guess there was, there was, I wasn't forming, like I didn't have a boyfriend, long-term boyfriend at uni or anything like that. I did date, but nothing kind of serious. And it just everything just felt like it wasn't working, and that the fault of that was me.
And that's part of
And
depression, isn't
actually,
it?
what was quite helpful was, after I finished university, I went moved back to my parents' house. And I would never, ever, ever recommend this. I mean, you should always work with the medical professional who's working with you. But I decided that I was really not enjoying being on antidepressants. I've been on them for a couple of years by this point. They gave me very vivid dreams. I sometimes struggled to know when I woke up what was real, what wasn't real. So I found that quite difficult. And I was on the kind of maximum dosage that you could have. I have to be very careful because the company that made the manufactured the serotonin enhancers that I was given have previously, been quite litigious when people have said that they've had certain side effects, one of
Okay.
which includes suicidal thoughts. So I won't use the brand name, but I struggled on them, and I think in hindsight they probably weren't the right medical
Yeah.
intervention for me. So I moved home and got a job in my local newspaper, and worked my way up. Just worked really, really hard. Worked in local papers, local radio, sort of national radio. Then I managed to get a job at the BBC, and I kind of I went sort of stopped taking antidepressants altogether. I started managing myself, and this is still the way. I always promised myself when I came off them I would never go back on antidepressants ever again, and I never have since my very early 20s. And when I feel myself getting bad, like I have coping mechanisms that I do. So I try and have a more regular bedtime, so that I sleep. I try and have a sleep kind of pattern. I exercise more. I tend to try and make sure that I go to church a bit more. I talk to my partner, and make sure that if I'm drowning, that like I'm not drowning on my own. And I make short and medium term goals, and I write lists, and I tick them off. And I when I say that I manage my mental health and I manage my depression, I mean I have physical coping mechanisms that I use, which I have decided in my head along the way are what works for me. And that's what I do in order to kind of make it happen. And I've always said that it would have helped me if I had known at the time, way back when I was 18 years old, to have people that were in kind of big, hard, pressurized jobs say that they also manage this. It would have helped me to know that I can still go on and do things and have ambitions in life. And it's so much better now when you have people like, business leaders or Prince Harry or sportsmen or whatever it is talking about it. You realize that it's not a barrier to success, however you define that for yourself. So that's why I'm, happy to come and speak to you. It's why I spent 3 years chairing ITV's Mental Health Advisory Group. It's why I've done a bit of work in this space, both kind of in a sort of structured way, but also helping people sort of sometimes individually, because I've always thought that depression is a bit like gaydar, in that people who are depressives, and I am a depressive, I just manage it, can usually see other people that are having difficulties in the same space. You can identify them.
But
I
isn't it
don't know
the,
if you feel the same.
yeah, I do, but isn't it the fact that one, it's invisible most of the time, so it's not like, your injuries you had as a young kiddie, so which is very visible, and that begs compassion and understanding for people. If I mean, I've been, I wouldn't say guilty of this, I've received it rather, is where I'm feeling absolutely dreadful and everybody thinks you're a miserable old git. Or just trying to bunk off or something, because the language isn't there at the moment. It's getting a lot better, I admit, but certainly when you were dealing with it in your in you know a few years ago, there was no language then to actually describe what how you were feeling.
Yeah, so I mean, like I say, I mean, I think my diagnosis was probably 25 years ago, and I think the language has changed hugely. And
Yeah,
I
it
think
has.
that you can actually say to an employer, I'm really sorry, I'm really struggling. can I work from home today? Or I'm afraid I'm going to have to take a couple of days to try and get myself back to where I need to be, or whatever it is, or to be able to go to your GP and to articulate kind of what you think is wrong and be able to you know, have the GP write a letter that explains to employers. So I think in terms of the kind of crushing, overwhelming inability to act, and that sometimes goes along with it, that inability to get up in the morning. That
it's your black blanket, isn't it?
To be able to execute things, to undertake tasks, to see them through, that kind of oomph that you need can sometimes be a big part of it. It's not for, you know, that's not how everybody experiences it, but some people do experience it like that. And I think that more or less people are, even if they're not able to find the words when they're presented with somebody that's trying to explain that, there is a general understanding, and it's not just a case of people thinking, oh, you're lazy or you're trying to get out of work or whatever. I don't think it is that anymore. I think that people understand that mental ill health is, for want of a better word, genuine and valid. I think that the problem is that it still, I don't think, has parity, like you say, with somebody that you can see has a physical physical ill health of some kind, whether it's whether they have a condition that has a name, like a disease, or whether they have a physical impairment, which means that they need an aid to either walk or they use a wheelchair or whatever. You know, I think, like you say, there is the kind of visual cues are different, and the language is different. And I do think even in the way that we fund services in this country, you know, mental health is still a bit of a Cinderella service. I can't speak for England, but in Scotland, you know, the number of kids that are on CAMHS waiting lists and things like that, you know, it can be 2 years from presentation to actually seeing somebody. Yeah. Now, you wouldn't have a child wait 2 years to get their broken leg set.
No.
You know?
No, you wouldn't. But there's still a stigma, isn't there? And I mean, for me, I come from a business background, yeah. So for me, it was about the behaviour at work that was the worst thing for me in terms of setting me off. And I think you described it as a black blanket, and I describe it as a black hole, but essentially it's the same thing, where you disappear into this well of dark blackness that you can't get out of. And it's people at work, particularly as I got higher up, the bullying and the level of aggressive behaviour was just unbelievable. And it's behind closed doors as well when you're in a board of directors meeting.
Yeah, I mean, well, one, I'm very sorry that was your experience.
Thank you.
But for me, it's, like Churchill talks about the black dog that follows him around. It was never that. For me, it has always felt like either like a very black blanket or duvet that's kind of above my head and is coming down and threatens to kind of smother me. It's like almost asphyxiation thing. Like
your brain gets completely overwhelmed by it.
And it can be overwhelming. In terms of I got distracted there in terms of thinking about how I would describe it. What was the question that was at the beginning?
I don't think there was a question, actually.
Right.
It was just a comment about the culture in business where people are seen to be successful by behaving in a certain way, which then filters down through the whole of the organisation. And quite often, particularly in entrepreneurial businesses, the behaviour that they get away with is absolutely outrageous, but nobody will call it out because they're in fear of their job and their financial security and all of those sorts of things. So people sit there in silence. They're always there. They're always present. They're always on. And they're going through hell inside their head, but nobody knows. And their fear is that they talk out and that's it. Their career's
gone. Yeah, and I think, you know, I think, so I have now transitioned to doing board work for a couple of big companies. And I think the good companies get it. I think the good companies understand that actually making sure that occupational health is more than just somebody coming around saying, do you need a special chair, love? They're actually making sure that their work...
I'm sorry for laughing, but yeah, I mean, oh my God.
But you know what I mean?
I do. I know, that's a great way of describing it.
Ergonomic mouse.
Yeah.
But actually, making sure that you have teams who are... supported, that feel like they're able to bring themselves into the workplace, that feel as if their contribution is valued. You know, you get much more out of that as a business. And certainly, and perhaps I've just been lucky, but certainly the companies that I'm involved in, if there was any suggestion that a senior manager was bullying any member of their staff or who was undermining their contribution, and that had anything to, related to something to do with their health, I mean, that manager would be out the door before they were able to put their stuff in a cardboard box, because that's not how you build successful companies. It's not how you build successful
No,
teams.
you're right. I mean, the business case is compelling for mental health at work, but it tends to be the bigger companies, perhaps the ones that you're associated with, that do take it seriously. And some of the smaller companies don't, because the people just don't. And sorry, no, go on.
I was going to say, I mean, I think, you know, there are advantages to companies that have, you know, a personnel department or human resources that have people that are able to, you know, not just understand, but able to direct you to help, or who are able to use language and best practice. And you know, I think there's all of that, but irrespective of whether your company has 5 employees or 500, there is a kind of basic leadership which says my team will work better if they're not sitting hiding a huge part of themselves when they walk through the front door, and that my team will work better and my company will perform better, and our results will be better if people feel able to explain what's going on, in their life, and we can find ways to work around things if need be, or find ways in which we can better support somebody.
Yeah, I agree entirely. I mean, I still think we've got a long way to go on that in certain the sort of small, medium enterprise organisations. Very much better at senior levels in big businesses, but it's still that bit when you get behind a closed door. And frankly, the non-execs that I've worked with don't care about your mental health. All they're worried about is performance and shareholder return. And, you know, that's their job, fine, but.
You know, that's the difference, because I have chosen to work for companies that aren't limited companies. So we want to invest in longer term. So I work for a mutual insurance company. I sit on the board of a mutual insurer. I sit on the board of a family food manufacturing firm. I sit on the board of Scottish Rugby, which is a very, you know,
Oh, wow.
multi-headed body. And it's, you know, none of these are looking for short-term shareholder return.
No. You see,
They are looking.
I
You
think.
know, they are looking. They've all existed for the best part of 100 years, in some cases more. You know, in some cases a lot more. And they want to continue. They want to have medium to long term success, not just short term return. But I have chosen that on purpose, and I think maybe that there is something in that, the idea that if you want longevity in business, that there are certain things that you need to do to support your workforce and to have that vision.
Yeah, I think people are becoming more discerning about the companies that they decide to work for. But in the big commercial world, if you like, if I can put it like that, it's still the profit motive that dominates. And I was into, I can't remember who it is I spoke to, but they suggested that we have a capitalism 2.0 where returns and indeed share price, for example, is not based on profitability returns. It's based on something else to do with culture or well-being or like working there, happiness factors or something like that. And I just thought, you know, Christ, it's probably impractical these days, but it's quite an interesting idea.
Well, look, I think we have had, in a different way, we've had a reset, where, particularly because the employment rates at the moment are quite high, that there is, you know, talent is scarce, that it is in many cases a bit of a buyer's market for employees in certain sectors who can go and say, yes, I will accept your offer of employment, thank you very much, but I want to work 3 days a week from home, or 4 days a week from home, or, you know, and I want to work, or I only want to work a 4 day week because I want a better work life balance. I think people are beginning to flex their muscles on that. One of the areas where I worry slightly, is that sometimes, far from work being a problem, work can be a savior and it can be a safety net. And actually, it can be sometimes where people find you and can give you support. And I do worry about the idea that people who are struggling most, spending most time out of the office, not being seen by their colleagues, and perhaps not being helped or being offered a route to even just talk about it. Because actually sometimes you can make things seem better and less frightening if you're able to have honest conversations about them.
That's a really interesting idea, because for me, when I was going through a particularly bad period and I was at work during my working years, the thought of going to work and talking to somebody about it was the last thing that I wanted to do. I would just hide behind it. And that's about shame. It's about beating myself up. It's the stuff that you were talking about earlier.
And that's the thing, because you talked earlier about kind of stigma. And I think the external stigma is much less than it was 25 years ago.
Yeah, I agree with that. Yeah.
100% less. But I don't doubt for a second that the idea of shame, guilt, failure, desperation, hopelessness that people feel when they're going through it themselves, I think that's exactly the same as it was when I felt it 25 years ago and have felt since in places. I don't think nobody judges you as harshly as you judge yourself, ever. Nobody ever judges you as harshly as you judge yourself. And nobody beats you up the way you beat yourself up.
It's about self-compassion, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And sometimes you can learn to like yourself and give yourself a break and be kind to yourself. And sometimes you'll never get to a space where you think that you are deserving of your own love, and that's a very hard road in life. But external validation, so feeling like you are contributing to something, feeling like you are appreciated in a workspace. I have always found work good for my mental health.
Being busy?
Yeah. It's not just being busy, but it's also a sense of accomplishment. So work can be more than just going into an office.
Yes.
Work can be, making sure that I've, built the bookcases behind me and I've got something to show for my efforts. Yeah. It can be, the idea of output, actually, I think more than work. So, the idea of input with a successful output has always been very, very helpful to me.
Yeah. So politics, though, politics is very different, isn't it? Because I don't know anything much about Westminster or Holyrood or whatever. A friend of mine is a politician, actually, and I just can't imagine that it's not a toxic environment. I may be wrong, but that's the feeling I get.
Yeah, I mean, I think so. When I started, it was just as kind of Twitter was getting off the ground, and I think it's more toxic than it used to be. I think it's more toxic than when I started. Mm. I stood in my first by-election in 2009, I think the kind of the social media hate has definitely, by any measure, gotten worse between now and then. In terms of building alliances, and politics is odd because it's very intense. So some of these jobs where you spend a lot of time in the trenches with a small group of people, and you spend more time with your workmates than you spend with your wife during an election campaign or whatever it is.
Yeah.
There is a kind of camaraderie and a bond that happens that's very, very strong. So in a weird way, despite the fact that being a political leader can be quite isolated and you're the person that's tied to the tree that folk are firing arrows at, there is also still a space where, you feel like you have a role and a purpose and you've got other people that you respect and admire and who are smarter than you and who are brighter than you and who are more accomplished than you that are helping you run this massive organization, and it's responsibility as well. So I mean, I'm a Presbyterian Scot and I didn't realize just how much of that is kind of coded into me, and so much of my measure of myself is not about trying to achieve or to make people proud of me. It's about not letting people down. This idea of letting people down is the scariest thing ever. It is the biggest motivator. And when I was catapulted, kind of 6 months after becoming a professional politician, I suddenly was leading a political party, having never managed an organisation or even a section or even a person in my life.
Wow, I'm smiling, but wow.
It was the biggest learning curve ever. And this absolute terror that I would let people down and not just let people that, whose mortgages relied on my performance, because, for every sort of MSP or MP that you get elected. There's another three or four people that work in the offices, and then there's, you know, there's the staff that work back at the parliament, and then there's the staff that work at, you know, there's this pyramid of people surrounding every single one that you get. So, you know, if you lose an election or you lose people at an election, suddenly there's 20, 30 people whose entire jobs have gone overnight, and that's your fault, you know, and this idea of letting people down was huge. And also, you know, I was incredibly proud and made a sort of vow to myself that, you know, being gay wasn't the only thing about me. I wasn't going to talk about it all the time, but I was never going to shy away from talking about it as the first openly gay sort of political leader of a major party anywhere in the UK before, and the youngest at 32, so pretty inexperienced. You know, I had to make decisions, you know, what I would do and what I wouldn't do. And this idea, like, the absolutely overwhelming thing at the beginning was don't be shit. Like, don't be terrible, because people think that all gays are terrible and it'll upset everybody who happens to be gay who wants to get into politics back 20 years. So that like, don't be bad just made me just work like a demon, particularly for the first 2-3 years. I mean, I was working unbelievable hours be terrible at the job.
Sorry to interrupt. Oh no, Karen.
No, yeah. I say, but you know, some of the people I worked with, even though it was a difficult job, and your opponents, they only go up if you go down. So they're trying to not just beat you, but they're trying to discredit you, and they're trying to say all these mean things about you. And you know, it's much kinder, I've found, since I've left in business, than it, you know, even with people that are competitors, they're not adversaries, are not enemies, you know, it is different. But the people you work with, I mean, that sense of being in the trenches with somebody is incredibly strong and quite nourishing, actually.
In Parliament or in business?
Partly in Parliament, but for me more it was sort of like my party director, my chief spin doctor, my head of policy and my chief of staff. So it was permanent employees that worked around me that helped run the organisation. I did have friends and do have friends that are also elected politicians, but actually the kind of core team was a staff team. And, you know, I was the kind of steering wheel on the car, if you like, but I wasn't the engine. And it was the way I kind of saw it. So I was the kind of front man, but there was all these people working very hard behind to, you know, give me the material that I could use, that I would help me be able to articulate my ideas, who would, you know, make the trains run on time, get me to events, you know, help me, you know, maximize my time, help make sure that when I was there, I was well briefed, that I, you know, was on top of everything, that, you know, and when it comes to elections, I mean, it's madness. It's like 14, 16 hour days every day for 6 weeks at a time. And they're brilliant. I love them. And for me, I mean, the biggest thing I had to think about was when I stood to lead, I was worried, genuinely worried, that my mental health might not be up to it and I would let people down. And because when I stood, we knew there was an independence referendum coming for Scotland, and this was going to be the most important thing I ever did, because that mattered to me much more than party politics. You know, keeping the country together is enormous.
Yeah.
My worry was that if I had an episode, or if I couldn't cope, or if the pressure became too much, that I would let people down, or that I would be found out as well, like sort of these twin fears. And actually, I found that my mental health improved exponentially after 2014, because I'd been tested in a way that I knew I would never be tested in again, and I'd passed the test I'd set in my head. Did I perform kind of well? Now, I didn't get everything right. Yeah, there was TV debates I did that I, you know, I wish I'd said X or Y or whatever. But like, I'd done this massive, massive thing.
How do you deal with the?
Which was great, but that I also hadn't let people down.
Yeah, like, because I'd letting
part in it, and that. That absolutely changed the way that I looked at myself, the way that I have treated myself since. It was a real big awakening for me.
As a politician, though, you're inevitably going to let people down, aren't you? Because, you know, you are going to be grilled, questioned, challenged, accused, all of those sorts of things.
Yeah.
Probably in public, stood up at a rostrum or something, you know, or even just in the Parliament in Scotland, or indeed Westminster, for that matter. So how How do you deal with that, though, given that you're letting people down, potentially, some people?
Yeah, so getting beaten up, having another politician like smack you around the walls for a bit, and maybe beating you in a debate, in a weird way, like it's not fun. Like you bear the scars, and it's quite attritional. But in the kind of in the scorecard I keep in my head, that's not necessarily letting people down if I did the best that I could in the circumstance that I was in, because sometimes in a debate or a first minister's questions or something else, sometimes you don't have the strongest hand, like a deck of cards. Like sometimes you don't have the strongest cards to play, and it's about some days it's getting out of there with the least number of wounds inflicted on you, and other times it's about making your point in the best way possible and perhaps landing a few blows on the opposition. So there's defensive politics and there's there's offensive or kind of front foot politics, and they're different skills. And so sometimes, even if you've lost on points, you've still got out of there. You live to fight another day, and that's okay. On some days that's enough, depending on what subject it is and what the record of the party is, or what's happened.
That takes some strength.
Sometimes you have to be a bit more philosophical about it. Because I don't live it every day now, I can look back on it with a longer lens. At the time, if you do a bad performance, you feel like it's terrible. And if it's written up in the papers the next day, or in one of the sketch writers writes that, somebody had you on toast, like you never like to hear that. But you have to have confidence in yourself that you can fight back and that you're still contributing and that you're doing the best job that you can do, and that you're still the best person for the job out of the team that's there. And sometimes you don't have time to indulge yourself in licking your own wounds. Sometimes you've just got to move on to the next thing and get the job fucking done. Get it fucking done. Sometimes it's just the mantra.
Yeah, you see, for me, when I was getting beaten up in the boardroom or doing a presentation to the city or whatever it was, my reaction to that is I would just go completely inside myself. I'd disengage. I probably wouldn't say much else in the meeting or whatever. Obviously, when you're you're making a presentation to the city and you're trying to answer questions, you have to do the best you can. But I would come out of that feeling absolutely awful, and it could take me a day, a month to get over it.
Yeah.
I just didn't have the strength.
I have felt terrible. There have been, I have done the crying in the night thing. Like, I have gone home or even just back to the office and shut the office door and wept. Like, I can't even count how many times I've had to go home and have a cry or a drink or whatever. But the next day, I've always had to make myself get up, put on my suit, put on my makeup, get myself out the front door, put on my armour, and get it done.
Yeah.
Because there was too many people relying on me to not make myself do things.
Yeah. Have you ever had the feeling we can't get out of bed? A bit like Alistair Campbell does occasionally. Because I do. Yeah.
Yeah. I still have that feeling sometimes. But I now have a child who's now five, and again, I can make myself do things I don't want to do.
Yeah.
I have... Don't get me wrong, I'm not trying to be on here saying that I've cracked life. I really haven't. Like I really haven't, but I can force myself to do the things that need doing.
But you're doing them for other people, aren't you? So you're, like, for example, in politics, you're doing things because you believe it's the right thing for the other people in the country or wherever.
Yeah, and that's where I think I was very lucky, actually. The fact that I became leader almost immediately means that I didn't really have to go out into the media and say stuff I didn't really believe in because that was a party position. Because when you're the leader, your position becomes a party's position pretty much.
Yeah, it does.
You can set it. And there is a real luxury in being able to easily 99 times out of 100, be able to go out and articulate what you believe. And when you do believe it, I sound sanctimonious or righteous or something here. It's not like that, but there is, that gives you a kind of sense of well-being that you can look yourself in the mirror at night.
Yeah, maybe I didn't believe what I was saying and I felt inadequate and shame and, you know, not good enough, an imposter, blah, 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 however you want to describe it. And I just don't, you see, I'm a man, obviously, but white, arrogant accountant who thinks I don't need any help, I can do this on my own. And there were times when I should have reached out to people and couldn't, because I just couldn't do it. And I just, did you ever get that sort of, with not being a white, you're not a white man accountant, but...
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, there are times where I absolutely perhaps should have brought more people in or reached out to them. And I wanted to be able to fix stuff on my own and be able to deliver for them rather than have them having to help shoulder the burden. I think that's true. But I think maybe the difference, or part of the difference between you and I, is with your accountancy background, the value that's put on numbers for you,
yeah,
and the
huge
value that's put on black and white things, you know, and right and wrong. You know, nothing that I've ever done, whether it's journalism or whether it's politics, has been that kind of absolute. It's always, I've always seen it about telling other people's stories, and it's about telling a story. You know, it's always about nuance. It's always about the way in which you communicate. It's always about the way you can reach people. And it's always about people, ultimately.
Yeah.
Both journalism and politics are about people. It's not about cold, hard number. Now, you can have a bad election and the numbers show that fewer people voted for you, or proportionately fewer, and you've lost, you know, good councillors or MSPs or MPs or whatever. Or you can have a good election and more people have voted for you. But that doesn't necessarily mean that you think that your manifesto was wrong, or that you were fighting for something that you didn't believe in. You know, politics is complex. It's the way in which you view it is not black and white.
Yeah,
we're
getting run out of time, Ruth, because I know you're on a deadline and I am sort of, but not as hard as yours, I suspect. But how does all of this affect your family? Because that is the most precious thing, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And, do you know, I think one of the things that is going to be helpful, I hope, is the kind of insights that I've had about myself and how I can cope and what I can do and how I can continue to function if things are bad, and kind of resilience that's been built up over the years and has been built up over now 25 years. I hope that as my son ages and he faces uncertainties and insecurities and all the rest of it, I hope I can help him build his resilience, and that he never wants to punish himself, he never wants to kill himself or any of the things that I went through. I hope that my experiences means that he never has to have them. But I also think that, you know, kind of having those experiences and having the kind of knowledge that I have about myself means that, you know, my partner and I are incredibly tight, and, you know, she can pick up when things aren't great with me, and very strong woman and helps. But also because of the nature of our relationship, you know, there's no kind of barrier there. I would never ever try and hide something from her, or hide that I was feeling bad or that I was really struggling or it had taken a lot out of me. And my parents have both got kind of chronic debilitating illness that they were diagnosed with about 6 years ago. And last year they were moved into residential care. And
I'm sorry to hear that.
Their main kind of carer, my sister lives down south, so isn't able to help as much. So I've had a real, really difficult time. And when the kind of seesaw tips between parents and children, it's quite destabilising. It takes an anchor away a little bit from you.
But you have other anchors to rely on, don't you? I mean, you
yeah, exactly.
It comes
and
across
my,
very
my partner
strongly.
Is absolutely that. Yeah. So the fact that it is a sense of proper teamwork and partnership makes a huge difference and makes everything better.
Yeah, you're not on your own. Yeah. Ruth, I'm sorry, we're going to have to wrap it up. It's been an absolute pleasure, and thank you so much for coming on in your busy schedule, particularly as it's election time. And you may not be as involved in it as you perhaps would be once, but I know you're going to be very busy, whatever happens in all the other things that you do. So thank you very much. And Cheerio. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning in to Just Not Good Enough with me, Chas Howes. As a reminder, you can catch up with all recent shows on FUBARradio.com.